Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now. But if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic full zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right, betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figured that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up, only with MyBookie. Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Mary Mate. How are you, Katie?
Good, you?
I'm well.
Well, you know what? I got to share with the Useful Idiots fam that last week I saw a great Roger Waters concert. Friend of show, Roger Waters. Saw him at Madison Square Garden. It was a great show. It was pretty cool. He had it was just an incredible experience. I never thought I'd live to see Julian Assange's name in big lights on Madison Square Garden, not on the marquee, obviously, but in the actual inside. Shirin Abu Akleh, also, he had the names of lots of martyrs and activists and heroes, different people's faces. Of course, there was the music, the poetic music. It was just a great show. I highly recommend if anyone lives in a place where that tour is headed, it's called the This Is Not a Drill, that they get tickets to see Roger Waters. It was a great show.
I was so bummed to miss it. And I'm even more bummed because he's coming to Vancouver where I am right now, but I have to leave a few days before he gets here. So I'm missing him coast to coast.
Wow. Yeah. It's almost like you're intentionally trying not to see Roger Waters. Wow. Aaron.
Absolutely not. No, Roger's been amazing. He's been just the stances he takes and the flack he gets for them. He's such an inspiration. And I've only heard just the ravest of reviews about the show. So
yeah, it was really excellent.
If you can catch it, go check it out.
And you know what's interesting? I talked about this. So your co-Grey's owner, Max Blumenthal, and I did we ran into each other at the Roger Waters concert. Didn't know that we were going to be there. We ran into each other and then we caught up and we decided to do a review, a little reaction to Joe Biden's speech that he gave last week, which you can catch on, I guess, on the Gray Zone and also on the Katie Helper Show, youtube.com/the Katie Helper Show. But while Max and I were talking about Biden's weird speech and the very weird lighting, I realized that it reminded me of another visual. And Wilson, I sent you an image if you could just show this. Because as people know, probably Joe Biden gave his weird, what's it called, Dark Brandon speech. There was this really weird red lighting. I realized that Biden, unironically, his lighting choice was very similar to Roger Waters' lighting choice when he plays this kind of fascistic character in a black leather jacket who has whose political party is, you know, a set of hammers. But of course, one is intentionally being fascistic and one is pretending to stand in the way of fascism. So I did a little who wore it better side by side between Roger Waters and Joe Biden.
Well, for those who believe that Joe Biden is kind of like a rock star, he has that status. This is some proof of that, really.
Yeah. Without the aviators, even when he's just squinting in the darkness, as he was in that speech, which is really weird.
Well, that's a great segue to our four food groups, because I have Democrats Suck. And for Democrats Suck, I chose this Joe Biden speech. So let's see a clip.
I will not stand by and watch. I will not. The will of the American people be overturned by wild conspiracy theories and baseless evidence-free claims of fraud. I will not stand by and watch elections in this country stolen by people who simply refuse to accept that they lost.
All right, so this was a major theme of Biden's speech, that he is standing up to people who spread wild conspiracy theories and refuse to accept that they lost elections and claim those elections are stolen from them. And as he is referring to Trump, he's being accurate. That is a fair characterization of Trump. The problem is, though, he's leaving out an entire other political faction, which is his own. And his own political faction, in two consecutive elections, has spread wild conspiracy theories about Russia. First with 2016, which was Hillary Clinton, where instead of accepting that her own dysfunctions played a major role in her loss, she blamed everybody, including Russia, and even claimed that the election was stolen. So here's a clip of it.
You can run the best campaign. You can even become the nominee. And you can have the election stolen from you.
So that's Hillary Clinton saying that the election was stolen from her, exactly what Joe Biden was claiming to be decrying. And the thing is, not only in the case of Democrats and Hillary did they spread conspiracy theories about their opponent, they paid for them. The Clinton campaign funded the Steele dossier, which is the most, which is like the wildest collection of conspiracy theories in American political history. It's a series of claims that the president is a Russian asset and compromised by a P-tape. There's nothing more wild than that. And so Biden, as like painting himself to be the opponent of these of this wild behavior, he's really leaving out a huge side of the story, which is his own side. And that happened again in 2020. When Biden's camp this time took the Russiagate playbook and then spread the wild conspiracy theory that Hunter Biden's laptop was really just Russian disinformation, and even got the tech giants like Facebook, as Mark Zuckerberg recently admitted, to censor stories about that. So we have a problem where both sides are accusing the other of engaging in wild conspiracy theories when both sides are guilty of pretty much the exact same thing.
Right. Also, something that Max and I brought up when we were reviewing this video, this Biden speech, is that what about people who say that the 2000 election was stolen?
That's a good point.
Are we conspiracy theorists? I mean, are we people who are election deniers? I wish that Al Gore had been an election denier in 2000. He should have been. He should have stood up against what the Supreme Court did, against the what happened in Florida. So, it's something else.
That's a great point. That's a great point. So if you don't accept the outcome of a vote, that automatically makes you an election denier. Well, that would then mean that we accept that George W. Bush was the rightful winner in 2000. And all those weeks of protests and mobilization around that were really just conspiracy theories. That's a really good point.
Yeah. So, for Republican Suck, we're going to, we spoke about this last week a bit, the water crisis that's happening in Jackson, Mississippi, where 150,000 people are without drinking water. So luckily, their water pressure has been restored, but it's not looking that great, because there's still an order to boil water to make it safe to drink that remains in place. And here's a little announcement that came from Republican Governor Tate Reeves, in case you guys are wondering about what could happen moving forward.
Second question, if you would be supportive of any privatization efforts of the Jackson Water System. You've talked about your concerns about the management from the city.
I'm open to all options. Privatization is on the table.
So there you have it. Privatizing the water is on the table. And that is always works out really well. Whenever you privatize water, that's a great thing. I mean, just look at Flint, Michigan.
Absolutely. It's crazy how after every single natural disaster, Republicans, their first response is, let's just privatize everything. The same thing happened with Katrina, where they somehow decided that a good response to Hurricane Katrina was to privatize the school system in New Orleans, along with many other essential services. And that's the only thing that their brains can go to when there's a calamity facing the resident. Let's find a way to profit off of this and take it out of the public's hands. By the way, I mean, we could do a Tate Reeves suck just every single week. I mean, he makes a constant appearance.
That's true.
He's also the guy who returned money to the federal government rather than help renters in his state pay their rent because he didn't want to have freeloaders or whatever he said.
I think anyone who is having trouble paying their rent should camp out in front of his house.
And, you know, and also, by the way, whenever there's a natural disaster, is there some kind of thing where you have to wear some kind of vest?
I know.
To make it look like
anyone believes like you're out there doing anything?
Exactly. To make it look as if you're taking part in the relief effort. It's pretty tacky.
Yeah, it really is terrible.
All right. Well, Tate Reeves sucks once again.
This week in Tate Reeves sucks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All and that hair is ridiculous. Yeah. Hey, I'm allowed to make fun of it because he has it. I think that's real. It's either a toupee or a terrible hair that's natural. So I'm only allowed to make fun of it if it's natural. So let's hope it's really his hair.
Not fingers crossed.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. Yeah.
All right. So for Isn't That Weird, we're going to return back to Democrat land. And, you know, right now, Donald Trump's in the news as always, even though he's the former president. We talk about the former president way more than we do the current president. That's just how it is. And so the current controversy with Trump is, of course, the Mar-a-Lago raid. And he actually recently won a court victory in getting a special master to review all the documents that were seized from him. And that's going to lead to a long protracted dispute that will ensure we're talking about Trump and documents for a long time to come, which is great news for everybody who doesn't care about actual issues like people in this country not having drinking water in Mississippi. But anyway, so right now there's all the speculation about what the documents contain. The Washington Post just came out with a story saying once again that they're related to nuclear secrets. But Joy Reid of MSNBC has a particularly unique theory on what is in those documents and what might have resulted from Trump having them.
We know that in 2021, that there was a rash of deaths of American spies. They were being caught. They were being killed. This is a very real and exigent circumstance. And the CIA has admitted to that. We are not saying that we know that there is some connection between the purloined documents and that and those events. But they did happen at a time when Trump did have custody of some really sensitive information that he shouldn't have had. You know, you think about that. You think about Victor Vesselberg, who's being investigated for something else, for fraud. But he's a, you know, Russian oligarch, sort of Trump in crony world. His house recently got raided. His yacht got seized. He's being investigated for something totally different. But Trump knows the kinds of people who one might want to investigate, who might want to do bad things to the United States and might not be on our side. And I wonder how frustrated you think law enforcement must be knowing that they can't look into any of that.
Wow. I'm frustrated.
You're frustrated?
I'm frustrated for law enforcement.
Yeah. I mean, look, I love that. She's like, I'm not saying that we know for sure that Trump got all these CIA informants killed. I'm just saying is that it could have happened because he had these secrets when they got killed. So, you know, I'm just saying, nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Also, I'm not saying that he's friends with people who want to do bad things to America. No, I am saying that. Like, what is she even? So look out for that, too. Like, I don't even what her net is pretty fucking wide here.
Very wide net.
Yeah,
it's a very, very wide net. And look, I mean, the most plausible reason for all the CIA informants being killed or caught is that the CIA is pretty inept and they have a history of burning sources and getting people caught. That's just what happens. And you can see from some of the people who now are paid as intelligence analysts on MSNBC and CNN why the CIA was so inept and why people have gotten caught. These people are not very bright and they're not very competent in the sense that they've been pushing moronic conspiracy theories about Russia and Trump being compromised by Russia, and then about Russian bounties in Afghanistan, if you remember that one, and then about Havana syndrome, where Russia or Cuba or China were like beaming laser beams and giving US diplomats brain injuries. So you can see just based on the quality of the analysis that we're getting from these former intelligence officials who now work for MSNBC, why, when they were in government and working in these posts, why they might have been not so competent and why they might have compromised their own people.
Wow. That is fucking weird. Weird indeed. Yeah. All right. Well, for Isn't That Terrible, I have something that's Donald Trump related as well. You know, it's a terrible world we live in when the thing that Isn't That Terrible involves Trump, but he's not the terrible. So I was looking at Twitter, as is my wont, and lo and behold, I kind of couldn't believe it, that the Rosenbergs were trending. Now, not sure if people know who the Rosenbergs are, but they, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, they were a couple. They were executed under Eisenhower at the height of the Cold War. They were executed in 1953. They were U.S. citizens, and they were convicted on spying on behalf of the Soviet Union. What's really disturbing is that they basically, the United States knew that Ethel Rosenberg was innocent of the things that they were charging her with, but they tried to use her as leverage to get Julius Rosenberg to confess. They thought that would work. They had two kids at the time. Neither one confessed. They were both executed, orphaning their two kids, Michael and Robert. Interesting story is that Michael and Robert were then adopted by Abel Meeropol. Abel Meeropol, by the way, wrote the poem Strange Fruit, which was immortalized by Billie Holiday, that amazing anti-lynching song. Anyway, that's kind of neither here nor there, just interesting history about it. But the Rosenbergs, the execution of the Rosenbergs was something that anyone who's on the right side of history looks at as a bad thing. Like, that is a dark chapter in McCarthyism. And, you know, you didn't have to be a communist-loving lefty pinko Jew to think that. The Pope was opposed to the execution of the Rosenbergs. It was a kind of a scandal. A lot of people appealed to Eisenhower to stop it. Albert Einstein, for instance. It really is a dark chapter in American history. And because people have brain worms, apparently, you have all these people who were tweeting on Twitter about the Rosenbergs because they wanted what happened to the Rosenbergs to happen to Donald Trump. So you have this gem of a person who tweeted the same thing we did to the Rosenbergs, and has a picture of Julius Rosenberg next to Donald Trump. It says, Julius Rosenberg was executed on June 19th, 1953 for giving nuclear secrets to the Russians. And then it has underneath it, hashtag Orange Julius. Get it? Orange Julius. That's a drink. And they think that the execution of Julius Rosenberg is a funny and also something that should be emulated and a time that should be looked back towards as something good and something that should be done to Trump.
But Katie, you have to give credit to a good play on words. At least I do. And Orange Julius, that's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah.
Good. If you talent. There's talent behind there.
Yeah.
There is.
They could apply that to something less evil than glorifying the execution of the Rosenbergs, and I'd be here for it.
I just can't deny that talent. I cannot deny that talent. Bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you scroll down from my tweet there, you'll see another tweet. I quote tweeted Michael Beschloss, who is a historian, presidential historian. He's often on MSNBC. I've made fun of his hair, and I can do that because it's real. But he thought it would be a good idea to tweet. I guess he was ahead of the curve. He tweeted back on August 11th. Rosenbergs were convicted for giving U.S. nuclear secrets to Moscow and were executed June 1953. Apropos of nothing. It's not like this was an anniversary of their execution. And shout out to Ben Norton, who tweeted below that, liberals showing they oppose Trumpist authoritarianism by ... praising McCarthy authoritarianism and execution of communists. Two sides of the same fascist coin. And that is exactly true. And it is a very scary moment indeed when you have people who are presenting themselves as liberals and presenting themselves as defenders of the rule of law, pointing back and looking back with a fondness at the execution of the Rosenbergs, which again was something condemned by many people across the world. In fact, you know, it's interesting, the All Black Labor Union, the International Longshoremen's Association, Local 968, stopped working for a day in protest also. So this was not a good look. And I can't believe we have to lecture people who claim to be the champions of freedom, democracy, and the best of that the U.S. has to offer, that the execution of the Rosenbergs is not something you should be hyping up. I can't believe it. Isn't that fucking terrible?
It's terrible. I have a follow-up question. How does Orange Julius hold up these days? Are people still drinking it? Because I remember it was had a pretty unique taste, and I just looked it up. I'm sorry, kid. Not that I don't want to downplay the seriousness.
You should invite this guy into the show, the guy who tweeted that out.
Well, I'd love to talk to him about his pun
creative
construction.
Process. Yeah.
Yeah. But Orange Julius, I just looked up. The beverage is a mixture of ice, orange juice, sweetener, milk, powdered egg whites, and vanilla flavoring. And I remember as a kid having mixed feelings about it. There was a time when I liked it, but then at another point, I think as I grew into a young man, a young adult, where I didn't like it anymore. So I'm wondering, what is the market for Orange Julius? Are people still drinking it? Share your feedback. I'd love to know, because I'd love to know how it holds up. I'm going to go try to find it, because I'd love to taste and it now and see how it holds up.
Yeah, see how it holds up. Made a really taste of America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, use the hashtag UsefulIdiotsPod and let us know. Let us know your thoughts on Orange Julius. I remember liking the name. I thought it was a cool name. This was before this pun, game changer yeah. pun. But I remember as a kid, I thought it sounded kind of like magical.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering now, if Trump does get tried for treason, for violating the Espionage Act, which liberals are supposed to cheer now because right. it's being used against Trump and also Julian Assange, will Orange Julius the drink take off in solidarity? Yeah.
Well, you know what I would like to have come back more? Although I guess they never went anywhere, but we should make little Cheeto Mussolinis. We should make little puff cheese doodles.
Yes.
Cheese doodles shaped like Mussolini. And that's yeah.
So many marketing opportunities.
So many marketing opportunities, yeah. But it's just so funny because Roy Cohn obviously was a big friend, good friend of Donald Trump, and he also was prosecuted the Rosenbergs. You're basically being Trumpian by siding against the Rosenbergs, everyone.
Absolutely.
I don't know how to break it to you. Yeah.
Yeah. So the real Orange Julius is the person who came up with the term Orange Julius.
Right. More like Julius Caesar, like mm-hmm. a dictator. Hey, Aaron, you know, I got used to the Cokies Still Sing, this great children's book written by Karina Gonzalez that used to perch behind you like a little frog. Like a little cookie perching behind you, crouching behind you. But I see a new book behind you. What is this? The Myth of Normal? What's that?
Well, I'm in Vancouver visiting my family, and my dad, Gabor Mate, has a new book out. It's called The Myth of Normal, and it comes out Tuesday, September 13th. It's co-authored by my brother, Daniel Mate. And look, I'm biased, but I think it's great. And it's a book about how we have a very toxic culture. And that toxic culture gets in the way of people's well-being and their healing. And the book is full of insights on how to deal with that and navigate your way through it. And I think it's a very, from what I've read so far, it's wonderful.
Wow. I wonder if we can get an appearance.
I can put a word in.
Yeah. Can you put in a good word?
I can try.
We have some more terrible for you guys. And this terrible is in the form of a stone moment. We usually bring you a stone moment of a candidate doing something stoned, acting-ish from the United States, but we're going to cast in the take a page from the great Joanne Reed. We're going to cast a wider net. We're going to cast our net across the pond and take a look at what incoming UK Prime Minister Liz Truss had to say when she was asked about using nuclear weapons.
Now, look, here's another question. One of the first things, and very briefly, if I could, one of the first things that will happen when and if you become Prime Minister, you'll be ushered into a room very privately at number 10, will be laid out in front of you what are called the letters of last resort, your orders to our Trident boat captain on whether you, Prime Minister Liz Truss, is giving the order to unleash our nuclear weapons. It would mean global annihilation. I won't ask you, would you press the button? You will say yes. But faced with that task, I would feel physically sick. How does that thought make you feel?
I think it's an important duty of the Prime Minister. I'm ready to do that.
Hurrah, hurrah.
Let's all cheer for a nuclear holocaust.
Yeah, let's do it, guys. That's how I like my lady boss feminists. Glass ceiling, shattering that glass ceiling with a nuclear blast.
I love how he had to remind her that he asked her how triggering a nuclear holocaust would make her feel. And the fact that she didn't answer the question suggests that she doesn't care, that she's a sociopath.
I know, right. Well, that's totally and that's what we need. That is, I mean, feminism means that we have women sociopaths, lady sociopaths, just like men sociopaths in office. Yeah.
And, you know, the way he framed the question, the way he first asked, it sounded to me like he was talking about her being led into like a romantic dinner. He's like,
yeah, I know.
You walk into a room. There's a spread. It's a darkened room. There's a spread. It's beautifully spread out. I was like, oh, is he maybe talking about a date? You know, what an ideal date. But no.
Date with destiny.
The date with destiny. It turned very dark very quickly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's one date I wouldn't want to be on.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah. Well, I'd want to be on that date if I could replace her, because I wouldn't press the button.
And that's why, Katie, I would vote for you over her for UK prime minister. Unfortunately, like something like 80,000 Conservative Party members decided who will be the UK prime minister, which is like, I don't know, like a fraction, like 0.101, like whatever. Like a very small, tiny percentage of the country just decides who the next prime minister is.
They don't. That's why we had to break off from them, because they don't understand democracy the way we do.
That's right. Yeah.
They could learn a lot from us.
Well, that is all terrible.
That is all terrible. Yeah.
But luckily, we have the antidote in our guest today, the wonderful Katrina Vandenhuvel, who is the publisher and editorial director of The Nation. We had her on in the early weeks of Russia's invasion. So we're going to check back in with her on her thoughts on the state of that war today, more than 6 months in, and also her reflections on Mikhail Gorbachev, the late leader of the Soviet Union, who passed away recently. And he was a friend of Katrina Vandenhuvel and her late husband, Stephen F. Cohen. So we're going to hear from her on her reflections on Gorbachev's life and legacy.
Let's go to Katrina. Thank you so much for joining us. We're so excited to talk to you. And we want to ask you about a bunch of things, but starting off with the death, life and legacy of Mikhail Gorbachev, who's someone that you knew. How did you know him? And what are your thoughts on his legacy?
Important question. My late husband, Steve Cohen, met him at the Soviet embassy in Washington in 1987 when Gorbachev came to this country. You're too young to remember, but he kind of jumped out of doors onto streets in Washington, and he was welcome in a way no previous Soviet leader had ever been welcome. And Steve had written a book about Nikolai Bukharin, who was one of Stalin's victims in 1938 in the purges, the show trials. And Gorbachev had read this book on vacation in the early 80s, before it was published in Russia, inside Russia, in Samizdat, Tamizdat. And it helped influence him in thinking about a direction of a country that wasn't a Stalinist direction. It was kind of democratic socialism, market socialism. In any case, Gorbachev met Steve in 87. He said, "You're not Steve Cohen because you're too young. And only serious people, older people, write books like this." But Steve stayed in touch, but very quickly in 1985, Steve and I couldn't get visas separately together for 3 years because of Steve's handling of dissident books, carrying around Solzhenitsyn. A week after Gorbachev came to power in March 1985, we got visas for the first time, and we lived in Moscow from 85 to 91, 4 months a year. We got to know Gorbachev after he left power, which was in 1991. When the Soviet Union was abolished, we can talk about that, and Yeltsin became president in one of the first fair elections in 1,000 years in the Soviet Union. But we saw quite a bit of Gorbachev in 92 and on, and in after he left power, and we continued to admire him as a great reformer in a tormented country, understanding that many Russians didn't feel that way. He presided over two very important domestic reforms, one called Perestroika, which was opening up the markets, in a sense, the economy. Glasnost was something he fully embraced. It was reform, rolling back 7 decades of censorship. And he cared so much about Glasnost that he invested in the creation of a new newspaper called Novaya Gazeta, new newspaper, which the editor of which presided over the funeral procession the other day and received the Nobel Peace Prize, as did Gorbachev. He received it in 1990, and Muratov Dmitry received it just at the end of last year. I think the most important thing about Gorbachev, I've come to feel, is his view of nuclear weapons, his view of an arms race, the perils of an arms race. He was the most radical arms reductionist to ever occupy the Kremlin, a heretic in that way. He believed in the abolition of nuclear weapons, which nearly came to pass in Reykjavik in 1986 with Reagan. But he did preside over, I believe, the end of two nuclear classes, the intermediate nuclear forces and another. And he came to believe that there was an alternative to the militarized NATO construct. And he was, I think, stabbed in the back by those who betrayed him in the belief that NATO would not move one inch eastward after the end of the Soviet Union, at the end of the reunification of Germany. And it did, it moved very far eastward. But just to end, Gorbachev really was a kind of heretic, in not a religious way, but in a way of taking on conformist thinking orthodoxies and trying to create what he believed was a, it's kind of a subversive word, a more peaceful world. He hated war, he hated violence, and there could have been much more bloodshed in the breakup, the ending, the liquidation of the Soviet Union as a result. There was some bloodshed in Georgia, in I think it was Lithuania, in the Baltics in early 90s, but nothing like what could have been.
And can you explain for people who are listening, because I think a lot of people who witnessed it don't fully understand it. And then, of course, a lot of our listeners didn't witness it. But how the Soviet Union actually ended, what Gorbachev wanted to happen and what wound up happening?
Yep. I've been reading the speeches at the last Supreme Soviet in end of August 1991. Steve spent a lot of time studying all the literature. He considered it, as some do, the question of the centuries, the vapros, or the question of questions. There's no question that the coup in August, middle August 1991, accelerated the centrifugal forces. But there was a possibility of maintaining a loose confederation, a kind of humane... Russia, there's a debate about it. I don't believe it's an empire. It's a multi-ethnic country. There are many explanations as to why it ended. One is that the elites of the republics wanted to separate. The other is that the economy was failing and there was separation. In many ways, what happened is you had, and I don't believe in great men, not great men theory of history, but you had in Gorbachev a man, person committed to reform, and you had in Yeltsin a person committed to power. And the clash on the Supreme Soviet stage in that those very brutal, anarchic and crazy sessions from like August 23rd to 29th, the resolution, the legislation to end the Soviet Union, to end the Union, not accept the Union Treaty, was passed. But then what happened at the end of the year is that three men, Yeltsin, the leader of Ukraine and Belarus, went into a forest. I'm not making this up, the Belovezhsk forest, and signed a decree abolishing the Soviet Union. So at that point, everything just, and you know, you see lineaments of this in Ukraine. I mean, Gorbachev was partly Ukrainian, had Ukrainian relatives. His wife did too. So many Russians do. And certainly Western Ukraine was moving out. But with the exception of the three Baltic countries, I think there was a possibility of a loose confederation that, you know, Putin is said to have said the greatest geopolitical tragedy. There are those who've really gone back, and I need to do this, gone back. I mean, whether it matters or not, but he said one of the great, not the greatest. But for many Russians, when Gorbachev died, there was a bitterness about the ending of the Soviet Union, because there was a sense not of communism, but of cradle to grave welfare state, of memory and nostalgia. And what they got instead was, as we know, and he's been kind of omitted from the obituaries of Gorbachev in the last days, Yeltsin It goes from Gorbachev to Putin. Right. The Yeltsin era was acclaimed in this country, but it looted a country and created a predator oligarchical class. The rates of poverty and impoverishment in Russia were much greater than ours during the Great Depression. I mean, it was a, and so what happened was Gorbachev gets linked with Yeltsin. And that's where it stands until Putin comes in and restores the state. But there was a bitterness about the destruction of the state. On the other hand, and I'll stop, you see the procession of those going to mourn Gorbachev the other day. Many of them are people who lived in that time, glasnost, perestroika. And I don't know if it was fully everyone online was there to rebuke Putin, but there was a sense of, certainly with Dmitry Muratov holding the picture, and that newspaper has gotten shut down as of yesterday. There's no reason Putin would have come to the viewing. And there is, you know, I don't think Gorbachev wanted a state funeral. Yeltsin, of course, got a big state funeral, and you can read into those kinds of things. But Gorbachev lived in a clinic for the last months of his life. He spoke out as he could about the arms race and war. He did turn away from news. He was reading Pushkin. And his family lived in Germany. He didn't really see much of them. And his wife, he loved so much, who he's buried next to in the famous cemetery, died in 1999. And her health was severely impaired by the coup when the family was held in exile in Crimea for 4 or 5 days. And she had a stroke, which is known, partly because she worried that they would be treated like the Romanovs. So she never recovered from.
I haven't seen what the Russian left has been saying about Gorbachev, but I do follow the Western left, and the critique that I've seen of Gorbachev made since his passing is that he is responsible for, at least partly, for the economic collapse of the 1990s. And like the image of that is that Pizza Hut commercial that he did, right? Where he did
that's commercial. So interesting. Let me just say quickly. I mean, I think he had, I mean, the idea that through perestroika, you could open up a society, particularly an economic system, in a few years after the decades of organizing an economy in the way it was. But the Pizza Hut ad was explicitly done to raise money for his foundation. He was in a state building for a couple years where he gathered those who had worked for him, and they did conferences. We went to a few on the Cold War, how to avert a new Cold War, thinking about socialism. But then Yeltsin ousted him from the building, and he bought a space and had it all done to be a think tank where there was some thinking done, but it was for that reason. Now, was it a good image? He also did, I think, a Gucci ad. Mm. I mean, and people went crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I think it's totally legitimate that people, you cannot eat glasnost. You know, I mean, we're looking at a debate right now about democracy, and I'm looking at Jackson, Mississippi. I mean, there, you know, you people in Jackson, Mississippi, in many parts of this country and the world, aren't exactly feeling the benefits of democracy or the debate, democracy versus authoritarianism.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that there's no question that, you know, people in parts of the vast country and in republics where you had certain kinds of leaders were not feeling the benefits.
And on the issue of, you know, Gorbachev securing this promise, which is absolutely clear from the archives that Western leaders from the Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush administration to its counterparts in Europe, promised Gorbachev that NATO would not expand one inch to the east if he allowed the reunification of Germany, which is a huge concession by Gorbachev, because Germany, of course, was the staging ground for the most catastrophic attack on the Soviet Union in its history, killed millions of people. So big concession for Gorbachev to give that up. But it wasn't. But that pledge wasn't secured in writing. It was made verbally. Now, is there a reason why he didn't get that pledge in writing? Would that have been impossible? Is that something that these states never have put down?
You know, he was close to two. I mean, the whole framework of being close to Reagan is in and of itself hard, I think, for people to understand. But it pro- but he was close to George Shultz and to a certain extent Baker, but there were real opponents in the administration who kind of gutted moving forward on an agreement. If he had pushed harder, I think one not so happy picture is that there were friendships, not friendships, but sort of collegial diplomatic relationships that emerged between Gorbachev's foreign minister, Shevardnadze, and Baker, and George Shultz, and members of the Gorbachev team. And as we know, there were abstentions, and there were this, and there, I think it was Iraq won. They kind of organized it, and there was a Russian-Soviet abstention.
Yeah.
I think it was a mistake, because at home he was viewed as someone who had betrayed the promise of Russia. I know a number of business people. I wouldn't trust signing an agreement. I mean, I'm just, you know, some predator types, not just business people, many kinds. But, you know, that might have helped him at home, where he said, I have an agreement. And yeah, they've subverted the agreement. I'm going to the UN.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it was trumpeted. It's in, you know, National Security Archives. I recommend anyone listening, watching, to go to the National Security Archives, run by two people who've done extraordinary work on documenting NATO, no expansion eastward, Tom Blanton and his partner. They have documents. So it, and Condi Rice in her memoirs talks about not one inch eastward. Of course, there's an ongoing debate. But there's so much vested interest now in NATO, it's impossible to get through. But yeah, he also went to the UN and gave one of the great speeches about outlining a new world, which was no NATO, but a kind of common European home, demilitarized from Vladivostok in Siberia to Lisbon in Portugal. And that got knocked out. You know, people listened to it. Surprisingly, Gorbachev remained friendly with German leaders like Helmut Kohl, and even though There is that history. But I do think that, as we know, people like George Kennan, the eminent diplomat who studied Soviet Union Russia, who was no lefty, thought it was the gravest disaster leading to a Cold War. And I do think it's important that we've seen NATO history relitigated or just reworked in these last months. Because during Trump time, Aaron remembers this, if you said something about NATO, it's, you know, and it's really working for the military industrial complex. I mean, you know, they would say you're pro-Trump.
Right.
You know, and in fact, it has a long lineage of opposition. Sadly, there was a real debate in our Senate. Bill Bradley, for example, and others were opposed. And there was a real movement. There has not been on the deeper expansion.
Yeah, a lot of Democrats, or a considerable amount of Democratic senators voted in the late 90s against NATO expansion. And now it's heretical.
It's now like
Trumpian,
which is a measure of how militarized our thinking has become. Because, you know, they had the Soviet Union at Warsaw Pact. They had Comic-Con. So I'm walking with, I'm sorry, I have to, Walter Mosley, who's on our editorial board. We were walking one day and he said, I'm going to Comic-Con. And I said, wait a minute, you're going to the Warsaw Pact?
That's so funny.
He said, Katrina, you need a life. I'm going to San Diego to Comic-Con. No, but seriously, you had no Comic-Con. You had, when Comic-Con went, that is the economic. When the Warsaw Pact went, the NATO should have said goodbye. Anyway.
Did Gorbachev ever tell you about that meeting he had with Reagan, where apparently they agreed to basically abolish pretty much all nuclear weapons, but then that got sabotaged, if I have that story right?
Well, and it's out there. Ambassador Jack Matlock, who was very close to the Reagan-Gorbachev negotiations as a former ambassador, it's known and it's quite astonishing. Reagan did believe in abolition, and of course Gorbachev did. They came very close, and Gorbachev spoke of it with great sadness and regret. But part of the, there were two problems. One, and I know there were others, but Raisa Gorbachova came with her husband. Nancy didn't. Reagan come with her. So Reagan felt he couldn't stay another night in Reykjavik to continue negotiating.
Oh my God,
so it was kind of arbitrarily cut off. Also, the advisors didn't want to leave these guys in the room alone for too long. And it's known that Reagan, a product of Hollywood, had really bought into the idea of, you know, Star Wars, the shield, He'd read up a lot on it. So there were different myths. In retrospect, Gorbachev had said that knowing it doesn't work, there were scientists and others in the apparatus who pushed him to play hard because that really broke it down, that there was no give on even testing Star Wars. One could have argued in a Machiavellian way that let the United States keep testing it. It's not going to work. But he continued to believe in abolition, as do now. You've seen the Wall Street Journal years ago had Kissinger, I think, and Perry and Saakashvili and someone else in support. And we had a correspondent, the Nation had a peace correspondent, which we need to revive. Jonathan Schell, who did a special issue on abolition.
R.I.P.
He interviewed Gorbachev and many U.S. And there's a myth that you abolish tomorrow. No, you have a process, but just the intent is, by the way, written into law. It's the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which the nuclear powers have signed and promised. And again, this is in writing, so that they will build down to abolition. But there are certain treaties which are not paid a lot of attention to.
No, and certain treaties that Trump killed, that Gorbachev and Reagan reached, like the INF treaty.
Absolutely.
Which had eliminated an entire class of nuclear weapons, and Trump killed that treaty, but that got ignored because it was inconvenient to the narrative that Trump was a Russian puppet.
I know. And the infrastructure of arms control is now gutted. It's shredded. There's one remaining START II, which could be renewed in 2026. But you're right, Trump, open skies.
Yeah.
And though it's clever and people say, bring your enemies closer, John Bolton under George W. was really responsible for abrogating, rolling back the Central Arms Control Treaty, the ABM. And he played a terrible role in the White House because Trump, this is not about Trump, but the lack of discipline and the not caring about these things. Bolton, if he's anything, is an insidious snake who knows the machinations of bureaucracy. And he did a pretty good job in gutting the... So it's a real danger. And we look out at Ukraine and Zaporizhia.
Yep.
You got the UN agency in there. But boy, it's a moment where there should be as much attention as possible to the peril, the dangers. And it does. There's an attempt to open up. So often the nuclear arena has not even been connected to the peace movement as fully as it might. And all those acronyms turn off people and they don't see connection. But I think there is a new generation, but cautious. Ways that we need more boldness.
I was listening to something that Stephen, your late husband Stephen, appeared on a panel with a bunch of diplomats, and
he wasn't one of them.
No, he was, I guess, an affirmative action
non-diplomat. No, he was like a troublemaker.
Right. they were, and he said something really interesting about the collapse of the Soviet Union and even the framing of it as the collapse. I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said that he didn't use that description because that made it seem inevitable.
Yeah, no, I mean, it wasn't inevitable. In the same way our CIA thought the Russian economy, the Soviet economy was in such bad shape, it collapsed, or that Reagan's military buildup, it collapsed, or that, different factors for the collapse. The Soviet Union could have gone on. I mean, in fact, Gorbachev comes to power in March 1985 for me after a line of people who were governing from hospital. The last leader, Chernenko, literally was set up in a hospital room to vote as if he were in an election booth. And just on the eve of Gorbachev's election, the Leningrad party secretary was going to be elected, but he gave a wedding party for his daughter and used the Romanovs china. And they were like partying like they were the Romanovs. So that didn't go down too well. In any case, it is not clear at all. The Soviet Union could have gone on. The economy was stagnant. People weren't living well, but it could have gone on. There was no real disaster. And so he studied all these different kind of views, and the signing in the forest was really the final moment. And there was a man who died about 3 months ago, Gennady Burbulis, who was a very close advisor, one of these eminences, these gray eminences, who was a very close advisor to Yeltsin. He died at about 75. He was in Kazakhstan, but he's written about it, how they needed to end the Soviet Union, and this was the way they were going to do it. And it made Yeltsin the leader and opened up kind of pathways of more power as things. But it was, you know, I'm not in defense of the Soviet Union, but there was an extraordinary disruption. And as you could see with the attitude toward Gorbachev, many recount his role, though he worked hard to try and save some version of it. He knew it would be a disaster. And I think that's what he thought a lot about in the last months.
Do you think he was maybe too trusting of the West?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. You also have a piece, you have an op-ed at the Washington Post about call it's time for Democrats to act on a dark money ban in primaries. So can you tell people what you're
proposing? So the DNC is meeting September 9th, and it has the right to make its own rules as a private entity. And Resolution 19 is to ban dark money, the undisclosed, the PACs. And we've seen this in this past election in primaries. So you're not fueling opposition, and it's not the classic, how can we end the arms race? We were talking earlier, but how can we end the arms race when they're still doing the arms race? This is about in the primaries. So a perfect example is that you had dark money in the Jessica Cisneros, Henry Cuellar primary in Texas. Jessica Cisneros is a progressive. Henry Cuellar is anti-abortion, anti-labor. And but the NRA dark money rating came in for him. We've seen AIPAC, the American-Israeli political group, pouring money, tons of money, in defeating Donna Edwards in Maryland. Crypto people, dark money coming in Oregon. So it's just at thenation.com, there is a piece about dark money, and there's a take action, what you can do. You can call one of the 33 DNC delegates who are supporting this, or those opposing it, or the DNC chair. We give a number and an email. But it will make a big difference, and it is something people can do. People like Jane Kleb, who is the chair of Nebraska, North Dakota?
I think Nebraska.
He's great. And she's been leading, as has Representative Whitmer, who's not Governor Whitmer, but
Judith
on the DNC. Yeah. So I recommend people just take a quick look at thenation.com to get a sense of it and then take action. Our revolution, you know, Pramila Jayapal, Jamie Raskin, Ro Khanna, Bernie Sanders, they've all pushed.
Jim Zogby.
The AIPAC interventions are very troubling and dangerous, potentially more dangerous. And, you know, the idea that raising this, as someone said on Twitter, was anti-Semitic is ridiculous. It's just, you know, J Street, what it is inside Washington is a counter to AIPAC. It's, you know, it's not Jewish Voices for Peace or, you know, I think AIPAC is setting up for masses of secret money, dark money coming in. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah,
Katrina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was great.
So good to hear from Katrina.
That's great.
One of my heroes. A lot to say about the topics we talk about every single week, and interesting to get her recollections of Mikhail Gorbachev, a personal take on such an important leader.
Yeah. And read her article that she has in The Nation about Gorbachev. Read her article in The Washington Post about Democrats' dark money. Follow her on Twitter. She's a very important voice.
Absolutely.
We didn't make it into the half of it, but
no, we didn't. And follow us too at usefulidiots.substack.com to get bonus content. And we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone. Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.